You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
There are some people who have something we require, and we want you to get it from them.
You ever kill anybody?
I hurt somebody's feelings once.
You labor or management?
If I was management, I wouldn't have given you a secret.
Who and how many are going to be coming after us?
You worried about saving your own skin?
Yeah, I am. It covers my body.
You just can't hold out forever. Impossible.
Oh! Almost a bit raspberry jam right there, eh?
What's the color of the boathouse in here for?
I don't like your attitude.
The color of the boathouse.
Oh, fuck off!
Welcome to Row Men, a 12-episode miniseries on director John Frankenheimer's 1998 espionage thriller, Ronin, starring Robert De Niro, Jean Reno, and of course, written, quite controversially, by one David Mamet and J.D. Zeick. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This is the 7th episode of Ronin, scene 7, from 51 minutes and 36 seconds to 1 hour and 1 minute and 21 seconds. It covers a huge expanse of the movie. It's the fallout of this failed attempt to get the case, the betrayal of Gregor and figuring where he is at, seeing the depths of one Stellan Skarsgård's Gregor with threats at a kid's playground and a phone call to an ice rink and the introduction of Katarina Witt. But if we had that equipment to triangulate where Gregor was, I need to know who has the equipment. And there's really only one man that has the equipment to cover this scene. It is the legendary writer and host of Increment Vice, Travis Woods. Now, in true Travis Woods style, about 40 minutes before we started recording, he sends me an 8-minute video, a film by Claude Lelouch from 1976, which plays, he tells me, and I now am even more jealous, at the New Beverly. Every time there's a car movie, they play this 8-minute Claude Lelouch film, which I'm going to struggle to pronounce, which is C'était un rendezvous. And basically, it's a hugely influential piece, which people who are listening to this right now are going to hear more about in later episodes. But Travis Woods, it's so fun to come and play with you again on a podcast. Talk to me about Ronin and this specific messy scene, because we are in scene 7, which is 51 minutes and 36 seconds to 1 hour and 1 minute and 21 seconds, which is the fallout of the heist, the really ghastly playground threatening scene from Stellan Skarsgård's Gregor, and then this little moment of CIA tradecraft, which is where to find Gregor. So it's a really sensational little kind of quartet of scenes lead us into the next big action set piece of the movie. But tell me about your relationship with Ronan.
First off, hi, Blake. Hi. Second off, I hate to correct you on your own show. I hate to do it. It's C'était un rendezvous.
C'était. See, I told you. That's good.
Which I would know because I flunked out of French 2 years in a row in college. So you really got to take my word for it on that. And I did send you that Claude Lelouch short film, and everyone should check it out. C'était un rendezvous.
I'll link it in the show notes. Yeah.
Or It Was a Date. It was just a 1976 French short film. Like Blake said, it's 8 minutes in which Claude Lelouch, who's better known for kind of historical dramas and romantic comedies and things of that nature, he strapped this tiny little Eclair Camflex 35mm camera to the bottom of his Mercedes-Benz 450 SEL and proceeded to just whipsaw all over Paris at 5:30 in the morning in August. A lot of people are out of town for vacation during that time. So the streets are relatively bare, except for a few terrified passersby and a whole lot of pigeons. And he basically revs this thing up to nearly 140 miles an hour, whipping around these Parisian streets. And the camera is strapped right to that beneath that front bumper of that Benz. So you get the classic Frankenheimer Grand Prix shot, the you know, where you're just chewing the road right underneath the camera. And it is one of, if not the, in my opinion, I don't know if you can have a car chase and it's only one car, but it is some of the greatest car action photography that I have ever seen in a motion picture, this side of anything that God William Friedkin has touched. And so I just wanted to mention that, even though we are sliding into a very non-car section of the film, a very post-car section of the film.
Yes.
Although I believe there's a Range Rover. I wanted to mention that because as much as this film gets compared to things like The French Connection and Bullet, I actually always think of the car photography in C'était un Rendezvous, or It Was a Date, being very, very analogous to this film. Not just because they're shot very similarly with that that under the bumper camera attachment, but also because director John Frankenheimer, he was a Parisian for a very long time and a Francophile, and there is just something about France that really spoke to him, and he lived there for quite a long time. And of course, obviously, this film is a European movie, and I think there's just a lot of connections. I think it's a fun little, if you're ever gonna sit yourself down or organize a screening either at your home or a local theater, if you're lucky enough, of Ronin, I highly suggest as your pre-show popping that one on the screen. It is a lot of fun, and it will blow audiences away.
The Lost Art of the Pre-Show. Can we just
Ooh,
for a moment,
boy.
The Lost Art. There, it doesn't exist in Australia. I hear about it from you a lot because there is such an amazing community of retrospective screenings that happen in Los Angeles and such amazing churches of cinema that are in Los Angeles. So yeah, there's some very special stuff where people get to have fun with programming. Program a short beforehand. Sometimes you're only lucky enough really in Australia to see like shorts before features at film festivals. So, and they're always like, new stuff, new experimental something in that voice, but it would be so nice to see more of that. But yeah, look, thank you for mentioning. We are going to talk about that in a very Paris chase focused scene coming up. But you love this movie. I think this is one of those ones where I started doing this project and it was one of the rare times where you were like, am I not allowed to come and play on this show? And I said, yes, I've already asked. And you're like, oh my God, I missed it. Okay, here we go. I have to be a part
of
it.
What's funny about that, in addition to my general flakiness, what's funny about that is that by the time I realized, oh shit, I haven't talked to Blake about Ronin. Am I going to do this show? I got to be with my internet husband, my honey bunny. And you sent me like, okay, well, here's the scenes I have available. And at first, what was I thought interesting about this is anytime that we've discussed me coming onto one of your shows before, you know, we're really close friends. And so I take a bit of propriety where I'm like, well, I'm going to do this.
You actually 99% of the time pick your scene before I tell people I'm even doing the show.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, to paraphrase that great cinematic landmark, The Rock, you know, you want to nail the prom queen. And so, you know, when I did Heat, I didn't get the tunnel scene, but I did get the finale, the hand holding.
I had a very beautiful message like literally a week ago from someone who found One Heat Minute and was talking to me about how emotionally impactful that scene was. And I was very grateful for their nice, kind words. And I said, and thanks to my internet husband, Travis Woods, he saved the show because I was inconsolable for like 10 minutes and Travis just had to riff and take over.
Well,
it
was your second to last episode. It was a long journey.
It was a long journey.
But you know, usually when you do one of these, I'll be like, okay, well, what's my scene? Like, what's the one? And, you know, like Manhunter, I did the strong as I am. And Also because Jordan beat me to the greatest scene, which is when Graham discovers the nature of the videotape.
That's Jordan. Whatever. We'll talk about it. You can't be jealous about Jordan.
I know. I mean, that is his scene. That's his thing. Whatever. I get it. But what's funny is when I realized that I was late with this, when I kind of, as much as one can panic about these things, I was like, oh, shit. Like, what am I going to get? I'm probably going to get, like, the dregs. And then I was thinking about it. I was like, wait, I started thinking about it in the moments before you sent me, like, here's what's available, here's what you can. I was like, okay, well, what do I want to go for? And I realized I don't have a favorite scene to this film because there is no. Yes, obviously, the car chases are exultant and exciting. I almost wouldn't want to talk about those, though. And I think the people that you have who are talking about them are the people who are best suited to do so. And I think they will make a meal out of it. But for me, I was like, well, what am I going to say that has not been said? Vroom, vroom, cars go kicky fast. Super exciting. Like, I don't know what else to say. But then I was also thinking, you know, almost every scene in this film or collection of scenes, 10 minute stretches, as we're doing today, you can make a meal almost out of almost any of them because this film is so consistent and is so pleasurable, and each, even the talky chit chat scenes are in and of themselves set pieces, thanks to our problematic pal David Mamet. He's not my pal, he's an asshole, but every, you know, there's, and so when you suggested
to quote Val Kilmer, I hate him.
Yeah, a very brave man to wear a beret in the 21st century. You know, I really was excited, actually, when you pitched me on this sequence because minus the car chase, which we worked in ourselves with the Claude Lelouch film at the top of this, minus the car chase, minus a car chase, this stretch of four sequences kind of contains and does everything that happens in Ronin. It begins with a bunch of people in a room just trying to talk out what the fuck just happened and how do we get through this and get this goddamn case. The next scene is a little bit of the shocking Stellan Skarsgård Gregor violence out of nowhere, which continually punctuates the film, like these little ellipses. Then we get a bizarre diversion into ice skating, which happens more and more as the film goes on. And then we have a long sequence of espionage and counter intel and Jean Reno and Robert De Niro, Sam and Vincent just being buddies, just dudes rocking. And so I was actually quite excited when you mentioned, like, this is the one I think, you know, we should do. Because as I looked at it, I was like, oh, yeah, this stretch is Ronin. Besides a guy playing with – besides not having a car chase or a guy playing with painting little toys, this has everything that Ronin does. But let's hit reverse. Let's kick it into gear, hit reverse. Let's go back. I want to answer your question, relationship to Ronin, or as I call it, Glengarry Glen Ronin, a film – because this movie is basically Glengarry Glen Ross for dads who read Robert Ludlum Bourne novels. All right.
And John le Carré. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, if you think about this, I mean, obviously that connection is explicit given that David Mamet, you know, wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, and he, rumor has it, essentially rewrote the entire script for this film into what it is now. And they're kind of the same movie. It's a bunch of guys in a room constantly yelling at each other, trying to figure out how to get paid.
Yes.
And it's interesting, you know, the first time I saw this, I think like a lot of guests, I saw this around the time that it came out. One of the first DVDs was at the, I think Ben David Grominski talked about that. It was at that switch point between VHS and DVD. It was one of the earliest DVDs you could get. And of course had that great Frankenheimer commentary. And I think like a lot of people, I got it and I dug it as this really interesting grown-up feeling, because I was a teenager at the time, grown-up feeling action film in which Robert De Niro basically is a smartass for the first 45 minutes. There's a car chase with rocket launchers and machine guns and a heist gone wrong. And then it dials back to De Niro just being a badass, pulling bullets out of his gut, a couple of more witticisms, and then a big, big action set piece at an ice skating rink of all things. Now, we're going to start broad. We're going to dial down to our sequence today. But speaking broadly, what I think is so interesting about this film now is, yeah, I saw that then as an idiot teenager. And I just thought, oh, this is like a cool, you know, kind of European badass heist car chase movie. A little bit sprinkle with some elements of French Connection, sprinkle with some elements of Heat. And voila, there you go. But as I've gotten older and hopefully a little bit more mature, it's really interesting to me, and I apologize if anyone hates this. I myself do not, I'm not really excited when people apply political reads to art, and because a lot of time I think you're just hearing what that person thinks about politics rather than what any film inherently thinks about politics. It is really hard for me to watch Ronin and not feel like I am watching a Michael Mann's Thief level scathing criticism of capitalism.
Yeah.
And of the American workplace, even though this is set in Europe, it is literally about a bunch of guys who have all lost their jobs. They've all lost their jobs. The Cold War has ended, and all of these ex-military dudes, they're all crashing around trying to find gigs. You know,
it is about the gig economy.
Think about it like this. All these Cold War ex-intelligence and ex-military guys whose corporations that they worked for, if you want to call them that, and we should, they've dissolved, and it's left these guys unemployed and forced to utilize their highly unusual skill sets as mercs. And what is a merc other than someone who is simply a freelancer, an operative set loose in a highly specialized gig economy? And that is what this movie is about. It's about a bunch of guys who need the money, who get hired to freelance a gig. And it's so scathing a critique of capitalism in that the line is drawn very early on where Jean Reno's Vincent and Robert De Niro's Sam, they're sharing a smoke the first morning on the job. And Sam asks Vincent, so are you labor or management? And Vincent, who just gave him that cigarette, says, well, if I was management, I wouldn't have just given you a cigarette. Yeah. And so first off, we establish that these guys are laborers, but we also establish that management are assholes. Management are monsters. Management, they are exploiters. And we see that made so explicit. Perhaps I'm just spoiled in the age of Venmo and PayPal and online banking and these little glow boxes in our pockets that can change economies. But it's so explicit how often physical stacks and wads of money are constantly shoved at these characters to make them go do stupid shit. Like the camera constantly lingers on physical stacks of cash, making subtext text in extraordinarily explicit ways where Natasha McElhone, or however you pronounce her name, I'm so sorry, Natasha, I'm so sorry. She's constantly handing these men wads of cash, like, go do it. Go do this stupid, dangerous thing. Go to this drop point. Get these guns. There's a scene, or I know I'm stepping all over the other people's scenes, but you know, who cares? We're having fun, Blake. You know, we're having fun. But there's a scene early.
I don't expect anything less or more.
Sorry.
You
sorry.
Are you,
sorry,
and
everybody.
This is what it is.
Sorry. I've had a lot of Red Bull this afternoon. So, you know, there's that scene where they go to pick up go to the drop point under that bridge to pick up a bunch of guns. And there's a moment where it's so clearly a trap. It's so clearly a setup. And Sam, Robert De Niro, he looks at Vince, he's like, you're not going to go in there, are you? What are you doing? And with this kind of angry weariness, which is why you get a guy like Jean Reno, with this angry weariness, Vincent says, I'm getting paid to go in there. And that to me is so much of what this movie is now as an adult As someone who's had real jobs, thank God I don't have a real job anymore. Hope to never have one again. But I have had real jobs, and they suck. And you feel exploited, and you are just selling pieces of your life away. And that's what these—that's what is explicitly happening in this film, is these men are selling chunks of their life away. This, in this case, to the Irish Republican Army. But you see these cycles of exploitation of labor or management versus labor throughout the film. You see it in how the critical friction in this film is about how management doesn't want to pay labor. The IRA keeps trying to rip off our crew here and not pay them. The Russian mafia, who, secretly Gregor, Stellan Skarsgård's Gregor, who's part of the team, he's secretly been double dealing with the Russian mafia to get this case. They would rather kill him than pay him. The head of the Russian mafia would rather let Gregor kill his girlfriend in the middle of ice skating than simply pay this guy's fee, which we know he can afford. He just doesn't want to have that on the payroll. He just doesn't want to spend that level of cash. And then we see how all of these managements, all these corporations, whether they are legitimate or not, because we're seeing the IRA as a corporation, we're seeing the Russian mafia as a corporation. And what is the mafia, if anything, but simply a capitalist enterprise loosed of any legal restraint, which is not much different than what we have now anyway. But we see them pitting the workers against each other too. We see how Gregor is immediately turned against our crew, our guys, the IRA team. And then hell, even our team, the way they massacre and murder the people that initially had the case. Those guys are all just blue collar guys too, just doing their job, hired to protect this fucking thing. And any I know I'm going off on a thing here, Dennis Miller style. I don't mean to go on a rant, babe, but I've had a lot of Red Bull. I'm so sorry. But
And also Travis is the only person I know that owns Dennis Miller action
oh,
figures.
we're not going to talk about that right now. It's a different podcast. But I liked him before the weird political stuff. Just so everybody knows, I liked him in the 90s when he was on HBO. Not the weird post 9/11 madman that we have now. But taking it back to a pre-9/11 place, the world of Ronin, that post-Cold War strange, nameless, formless era in which these men were loosed, and which these men were true Ronin. Because what is a Ronin but an unemployed dude? A Ronin is a guy who is unemployed. A Ronin is a guy who has lost his job and is now freelancing without a contract, hoping to not get fired. That's what Glengarry Glen Ross is about. That's what Ronin is about. And both are films about a heist that goes wrong and fucks everybody else over in the movie, and about a bunch of men who sit around in a room or various rooms after yelling at each other, trying to figure out what happened. But truly, more than anything else, they are angry and seething at a world that has left them jobless and leaderless and forced to be on their own, to create their own financial means of existence. Earlier, I think I called this movie Glengarry Glen Ross for dads who read Robert Ludlum Borden novels. No, this is Das Kapital for dads who do all their movie watching on TNT on a Sunday afternoon. And that is what leads us to the first scene in this stretch of scenes in which they tried to rip off the other crew. They tried to get the mysterious MacGuffin suitcase that has whatever it in it that the IRA needs, and they have failed. And now they are just sitting around in a room trying to figure out what the fuck happened. It's what happens in Glengarry Glen Ross after the heist. It is what happens in Ronin after the heist. And you see all of these people, these Ronin, which again, just unemployed guys. That's what Ronin is, the guy without a job. The guy without a job. And now their potential boss, their freelance boss, their point person, Natasha, is bawling them all out about how horrible they are.
Poor
That they
Natasha
are
really is really just an accounts manager who you're
and
asking for
and
your
and
pay.
and speaking of a scabrous critique of criticism, when even Natasha, she even says it in that scene where Sam is like, well, why doesn't Gregor try to sell the case back to you guys? And she's like, well, if we had that money in the first place, we wouldn't have had to hire you.
How is it out there?
A lot of heat.
Okay. Thanks before.
I mentioned. Could you clean the paint off this?
You got a pack of Camels in there?
No, you smoke too much. How many needs of people to help us?
And we need you to find the kiss.
All right, well, look, call the guy. Call your guy.
When we bring him the kiss, he'll help you.
How can I bring him the case?
Well, Gregor has it.
Why?
I presume to sell it to the Russians.
Why the Russians? Why not you?
If we had the money to buy the case, we wouldn't have hired you to steal it, would we?
Go to your people. Talk to them.
You want the case? We find Gregor, we find the case.
How do we find Gregor?
How'd you find him in the first place? How'd you hire him?
I found him through your friend, the cripple, who gave me nothing but a bunch of fucking lames. You and Spence and the whole...
Hey, sorry, you can find him through his cell phone. Can we trace his cell phone?
They can triangulate it if we had that equipment.
Who has that equipment? Who has that equipment? Tell me. Who has it?
All right. Give me the number to his phone.
This entire movie is about the degradation cycle of capitalism and how it destroys everyone that it touches. And I know that sounds like, you know, whatever. It's what's on the screen. It is what is on. It's no different than that scene in Thief where Robert Prosky's like, you know, you got a problem, join a labor union. He's like, brother, I am wearing it. That is what this movie is. It is so obviously a Marxist critique, which is interesting, you know, that it's coming from a real hothead like Mamet, who you would imagine would be rah-rah capitalism. But it's wild to watch this movie now because it does just seem like a really cool action-packed metaphor for capitalism, what it is to be left rudderless, what it is to be after the bubble has burst, whatever bubble you're employed in. It is a movie about the Cold War bubble bursting and all of these men turning into mercenaries because they don't know what to do with their skill sets, but they've been fired and these skill sets are all that they have. So they turn against each other in this hyper-capitalist world of European espionage and car chases. And what a cool fucking thing to make a badass movie about. My God, De Niro doesn't even have proper insurance coverage. He's got to get this old fart playing with toys and models to yank a bullet out of him. And the man doesn't even have proper insurance coverage.
He doesn't.
Come on.
And he also, I love his impulse for a quick, like adjustment of the contract. Well, if we're going to do this Mickey Mouse bullshit, I want $100,000.
$100,000 up front.
I want half of it up front, half when we get the case. Da, 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 and he says it, and then and he goes, and for all of them, he does collective bargaining for his whole team. And she's like, that is what I understood. Yes, that is what I understood. And it's okay, great.
It's impossible, you know. And again, it's not like I like to watch movies like this. I really don't like, unless a film is explicitly political, I don't like to view a lot of films through any kind of political lens, because again, I think you just start seeing your own belief system writ large across a movie. But in this particular case,
Quentin Tarantino said it best to me. I was lucky enough to talk to him. I know you have talked to him before in your life. When I interviewed him, he's like, Westerns are always, when he's talking about specifically Westerns as the great American art form and morality tales just in general, is like, Westerns always say much more about the contemporary political time in which they were made than the time that they were set. And I feel like that's what, you know, why relevant political engagement with a film is the most urgent and most important for me at the time that the film is made. It is then
it takes sometimes decades before you can like truly crystallize what the political lens of the film was, unless you're doing it like immediately and you're so steeped in the politics of the movie, which is why Ronan is interesting, because you can have a look at it in that way. And why Thief, I think, immediately as its release, immediately had that, criticism of capitalism, and it took European critics to be the first people to truly engage with it in that way. And that took like 20 years for people in, you know, Western critics, like, you know, our countries, to go, oh, actually, this is like a anti-capitalist movie in a really strong way. I think another movie that I really adore, Emily the Criminal, is like a very modern version of this. I feel like if you put like a little programming together and wrote Das Kapital for, you know, dads who watch TNT, the movies would be Ronan Thief and Emily the Criminal. I'd have to think of the next one after that. You would love.
I still got to watch that. It's on my list. I got a lot of movies I got to get through, buddy. I keep doing these podcasts,
and I keep sending you things that you need to watch. You know.
But to go back to Ronan proper, you know, one of the reasons why I think it holds up now, especially now, but I think also even then, you know, the dot-com bubble was about to burst. Fairly soon after this film was released, and I think it gained in power then, and it only continues to do so now, perhaps even more so explicitly now, is this is a film about a group of people whose politics, financial institutions, and commercial enterprises have all abandoned them. Yeah. With the Cold War collapsing, their governments and their forms of making a living for those governments have all collapsed and abandoned them, which I think a lot of people would identify with that feeling now. I think a lot of people would also feel would identify with the existing within the gig economy ecosystem and how that can feel like life or death now. And I think that is something that these characters are also struggling with, because that is, again, and I said it somewhat jokingly earlier, but it is true. What is a Ronin but a guy without a job? He's a freelance. He's a freelancer just trying to get something in. And the last thing I want to say, broad strokes, and then I'll shut up and we can actually dial a little closer to these sequences. I just want to mention that I always noticed when I first watched this movie, and I couldn't figure out why, to go back to your question, my relationship with this film, which obviously I hope it's clear I loved the second I watched it. One other thing I'll say, I got to do the obligatory Sean Bean thing, obligatory Sean Bean sideline. I love that this movie provides the context for the one flaw that I have always felt is in Heat, which is, why would you hire Wayne Grow? Why would you do that? Yeah. Why would someone as rigorous as Neil McCauley, sorry, everybody, we're gonna do a little Heat excursion here. Why would Neil McCauley, anyone as rigorous and stringent as he, why would he hire Wayne Grow? And this film kind of answers that, because you see, you hire someone like Sean Bean because you can't afford anyone better. Mm-hmm. We are living in that kind of world, that kind of economy. He gets hired because that is the best that that is the best that the IRA, Seamus and Deidre, that is the best person they can get for the money that they can afford. And I very much liked that. And it kind of retroactively gave Heat a little bit more clarity for me. It's, who are you going to get on the short notice? You're going to get a guy like Wayne Grow. You're going to get a ringer like that.
You're going to get a ringer like Wayne Grow because we don't want to cut him in for as much money as the rest of the guys on that
exactly.
job, because they're our guys.
Exactly.
Our guys exactly. are going to get 90%. He's getting 10. So when we do the splits, he's not even fucking in the split.
When he shows up in his khaki pants and dress shirt for the interview with his hair slicked back, you're gonna be like, okay, well, you know, he knows the answers, he knows how to handle a Glock. Come on, we gotta roll.
He's got a good reference.
He's got one reference. He was in Folsom Shoe B Wing. Yeah. He is a cowboy looking for anything heavy. So I do like, as we do with the obligatory Sean Bean sideline here, that it does actually provide clarity. And it actually does that for kind of all of these heist movies, where there's always that one loose cannon. And you're always like, why would they hire this loose cannon? From everything from Charlie Varick up till, like I said, Heat. You're like, why do you hire this guy? Why? And it's like, oh, well, it's because they're moving on the quick, and this is who they can get for the pay. They haven't made the heist yet, or they'd have more money.
And who's available?
Yeah,
like, there's probably guys on better crews, or there's probably guys who they used to work with who were in jail, like you find out with Don Breeden later, who's a great wheel man. It's like, that's a pure coincidence. They're like, oh, that's a better guy for other jobs. That guy.
This is the nature and the destructive and the cycle of degradation that is capitalism. You get who's available and who's willing to work for the pennies that you are willing to give. And so anyway, as I was saying, one of the things that I noticed when I first saw this movie, and I thought I couldn't figure it out, is it's a weird thing to notice, maybe, I don't know. But it's especially noticeable now that this film is available on a gorgeous 4K release. But you watch it now, especially in that first 30 minutes, when that opening scene, De Niro comes out of the darkness. Our boy looks horrible. He looks like shit. His nose is red. His face is gray from about a day without shaving. He's got saddlebags under his eyes. He looks like 3 weeks overdue for a haircut. And then he goes into the cafe, and you know, Jean Reno, who just, you know, couple years before looked so like kind of vital and muscular and bronzed in things like Mission Impossible and The Professional. Skip Suddeth as Larry. Just, I love Larry, but
I love Larry.
Larry, buddy, do a push up, pal. You've got Larry looking very kind of sallow, also very pallid, also with that gray face of not shaving for a day.
The only time he moves quickly is A, when he's cooking, and B, when like people are being gunned down and he's just moving stuff leisurely.
Getting those boxes. He's being a good wheel man. But, you know, you see him, even Sean Bean, handsome guy. When we first see him, both in that kind of that establishing shot where he's in, you know, looking down as they're pulling in. But also there's a lot of tight close-ups on him. He looks horrible. They all look horrible. Their noses are red and flush. Their eyes are red and glassy. That very kind of pallid, ugly, early 5 o'clock shadow gray. And that always kind of made me feel weirdly like a little cold. Like, where are my handsome fellas? Yes. I know these guys are handsome fellas. Who is more handsome than kind of mid-90s, late-90s De Niro? What's happening with my boys here? And it always made me think about how this is such a gray film, a kind of a colorless film. I used to even say, God, even the characters are kind of colorless and kind of ugly. And then I realized during recent rewatches, none of them are wearing makeup. Stage makeup, like movie makeup. And I started thinking about that. Film's a visual medium. I don't want to turn anyone's hair white by saying that on a movie podcast, but films are a visual medium. And so if there is an absence of makeup, that is just as important as slathering makeup on. Like Natasha does when she goes undercover as the tourist at the hotel. And it made me realize, oh, these guys are meant to look haggard and worn down and raw. Because why? Why? What are they? I'm going to bring it back to this subject one more time. Then I'll let it go. They're working stiffs. It reminded me, this is a weird pull, but Blake, I know you've seen it. I'm sure everybody listening has seen it. Tim Burton's 1989 Batman. There is a weird subplot where the Joker poisons all the cosmetics in Gotham City. And there's this... In the middle of that, in that stretch of the film, there's a scene where the newscasters are on the news. Highlight that they can't use stage makeup anymore, they look like some of the most haggard sons of bitches you've ever seen in your life. And now that I'm pulling that memory, that sense memory up for everybody that's seen that movie when they were a kid, that is what De Niro and all these characters look like in throughout this whole movie. They look like that. And we're not used to seeing our actors, our performers looking like that. They have like a base of makeup on, you know, they're made to look better, aestheticized. And yet they aren't here. And I realized, oh no, like everyone is just meant to look like a working stiff, someone that capitalism has chewed and at the end of the Cold War has spat out upon the concrete. And I just find that is, as is typical with a great filmmaker like John Frankenheimer, that just this extra special level of detail that I don't think you get in every movie of this sort. And it's the kind of thing that you lean on Frankenheimer for, at least in my opinion. And it is one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons why I think Frankenheimer was such the perfect director for this film, why this is kind of the quintessential Frankenheimer movie in a lot of ways, is because Frankenheimer was a journeyman director who also happened to be an auteur. And that makes him the perfect director for the material of Ronin, because what are these characters? But who are they? But journeymen who are armed with skill sets far beyond the average mortal man. And that is kind of what he was as a director. He had a journeyman's course as opposed to an auteurist, like someone like, you know, Friedkin, who I think he gets grouped in with a lot because of the French Connection saga. But he's just as much an auteur as someone like Friedkin, but he had a journeyman's career, a craftsman's career. And that is exactly who these characters are. And so I think there's a very unique connection there. So anyway, okay, I've talked about the ugly guy makeup stuff and Frankenheimer being a journeyman god. So we can actually talk about, you know, an hour later, we can actually talk about the scenes you asked me to talk about. But I think that is why he is the perfect director, though. That rigorous attention to detail to show us these characters are worn down by the work. But also, I think there's a kinship between director and subject matter in this film, so that he is the perfect person to show us these people haggard, tired, exhausted in a cramped, ugly, gross little hotel room, yelling at one another to what the hell happened? How did Gregor get the best of us? Why did Gregor get the best of us? And of course, the answer is, well, capitalism. And how do we track Gregor down? What do we do? And that is all just that's pure Frankenheimer shit. That's pure Frankenheimer. And to me, these four sequences are way more what Ronin is than the car chases. While I love those are sporadic staccato exclamation points at the end of very long, hour-long sentences. But the overall sentences and what those sentences are saying are the kind of things we're seeing in these four little scenes in miniature that are grouped together in this 10-minute sequence that we're talking about today. The people in a room trying to figure out how they got fucked out of money. Gregor running roughshod over Europe, shooting people with shooting people with that gun that looks like the gun that you would the zapper gun that you would use on Nintendo when you're playing Duck Hunt. I mean, we gotta talk about that gun here in a minute. But the ice skating ballet stuff, which is just such a leftward pull, such a weird left abrupt turn. And then finally, the bad boy De Niro espionage stuff. That is what this movie is, and that is what these four sequences are. And that is why I again, bring it around, why I was so excited to talk about this stretch with you.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion, or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
I love this scene too, and I want to echo everything that you said. I just love that it has the tradecraft. The tradecraft is so thrilling and exciting for me. The fallout scene is so genuine. One thing that I detest in a lot of films, and I think even the really best franchises like Mission Impossible have gotten so much better at it, is like when there's a fallout of a scene or there's a failure, like that people look beaten up, people are bashed around. The thing that infuriates me to no end is like in something like the Fast and the Furious franchise, which I know there are some great entries and people have a lot of enjoyment with those movies, is like you see someone like roll over in a car or get in like a fist fight that goes on for 20 minutes and then they get up and they don't have a piece of swelling on their face and they're not bleeding or they're not doing any of that. And it's like, I'm way more in the John McClane Die Hard school of like, no, that person should have the shit beaten out of them. That's what they look like. And so I love in this sequence that they're all kind of frazzled. You know, Skip Suddeth's Larry is just sitting there like, you know, looking like, you know, a bag of shit. They're freaking out. They don't know what to do. And then Gregor goes from Mr. Quiet, and he has already kind of alluded to that he is something more, and Sam has tested him with that coffee cup and he's caught it. You know that there's more to Gregor than he is letting on, even though you can't quite be sure that he's going to betray them. And then in this moment, you see that he's like a psychopath, an apathetic person who's like, look, I'll kill a kid in a playground. I don't care. I'm gonna navigate my way across countries. I'm going to sell this. I'm going to make it happen. And that's it.
See that little girl down there?
Have you lost your mind? Why did you do that?
Make a point. I don't know her, but I was ready to splatter brains all over the playground. But you, I don't particularly like you. Just imagine what I'll do to you if you try anything. Now give me my money.
And so, yeah, I love that sequence. But the sequence in this, couched in this, is just like the very, very earliest moment of like, someone could track your cell phone and find you. Like, this is like a what has now become a crutch, really, from this moment in Ronan all the way through the Bournes. The Bournes all leverage. The Bournes are all eating Ronan's lunch, as far as I'm concerned. And then really the whole last 25, 26, 27 years since this movie's release, the language of if you have a cell phone, you can be tracked is there. And I think that this movie, what is so like illuminating and enlightening is like, they can do it, and they have been able to do it for some time, and they can do it in this moment. And it's kind of like, oh, is that just spy shit? And it's like, no, that's everything. And I adore the way that that scene plays out. So I love all of these sequences equally, but that one particularly, I'm like, that is such one of my favorite scenes in this movie. Absolutely.
Excuse me. Did you tell me how to find the post office?
Do I know you? No, I'm sorry, do I know you? Because how did you know I speak English?
I got an English newspaper.
Sorry. Sorry, I beg your pardon.
It's all right.
What do you need a post office for? Because over here, you know, they use them for different things.
I need your help.
I thought you left.
I did leave.
You did leave. You're out.
That's right. Can you help me? I need your help.
What's the number? Yeah, the post office is just down on your left.
Up on the left.
On the left.
Thanks. Friend of yours? Yeah, we went to high school together.
Well, everyone's your brother till the rent comes due.
Ain't that the truth?
Oui. Oui, à la terrasse. Face à moi, je le vois. Oui, je vous l'appelle. Ne quittez pas, s'il vous plaît.
Well, to talk about the cell phone thing, early cell phone thing. What I do like about this sequence, that moment in this sequence, is even as it does the same thing, you know, like you said, where, you know, in other movies, someone gets beat up and they hop right outside. Their car will flip over 17 times. They hop right out. They're fine. They have like one like little thing of dirt on their forehead because that's all the actor would allow contractually. Whereas this film goes far further and is far more realistic. Similarly with the cell phone stuff, where there's that moment where, you know, I think John Reno was the one that asked him, you know, can you track his phone? And De Niro's character has to correct him. He's like, I can triangulate it, which means yes. I can tell you what city he'll be in. I can yes. tell you what city, like I, but like as to like, you know, where his house is, I don't know. We don't have that. It's also what's also interesting about that is you know, these characters are all being as cagey as possible without ever explicitly saying much about what they've done, where they've been. You know, even De Niro earlier in the film, when he talks about being interrogated, he immediately tries to brush it off with a joke about making a drink. No one wants to say exactly what they've done. But this is the first moment in the film where characters other than obviously, you know, outing Sean Bean as a fraud. This is the first moment where characters really start to lean on other characters' histories, where, you know, when De Niro is talking about how he might be able to triangulate the location, but, you know, he doesn't have the equipment. It's one of the few moments in the film where Vincent, Jean Reno, really presses him out of his comfort zone. He goes, who has the equipment? Who has the equipment? Who has the equipment? With the latent implication being, I know you've worked for the CIA. I know you are a spook. I know you have connections.
Yes.
You would know which brothers are in town that you can reach out to and get the tech to track this person down. Like, you know. Who, and the way he just says it, as with everything in this movie, says it without saying it. Who has the equipment? Who has the equipment? Who has the equipment? And then that is confirmed by the scene, you know, the sequence we're talking about today is bookended by these two kind of shoe leather trade craft sequences. That question of Jean Reno's is answered in the final sequence that we talk about today, where De Niro meets a fellow spook, you know, hands him the news, hands him the phone number, and like, this is, you know, they speaking in code to one another. And I will say the level of detail, the level of Frankenheimer detail in this film is such that when De Niro goes up to that guy,
and Ron, he's like, Perkins, hey, you know, is the man with the newspaper, is his name.
Do you know where the post office is? And it's all basically having a pretend conversation so they can have a real conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about that, and this is one of those things where this is kind of the ultimate example of how Ronin is a film of layers that only pays off if you watch it an insane amount, as the people on this show have done. They introduce themselves and as people that they pretend to be strangers to one another. De Niro and the guy that we will later see at the end of the movie is his handler.
Yeah.
Because De Niro is working for the CIA the whole time. He's never left, as he says. He's still a company man. He's technically, you could almost call him management. He's almost in a way the Alec Baldwin of Glengarry Glen Ross. Like, he's actually the one that's coming. He's come from Mitchum Murray to settle this shit because he's got, as he said, brass balls. So anyway, ignore that. When he pseudo introduces himself to his handler, pretending like they don't know each other, like they're American tourists, he then, you know, in that low sotto voice, he's like, hey, I need a phone number. I need you to find this phone number. And what's wild is in that moment, his handler goes, I thought you quit. I thought you left. I thought you quit. Now, why would his handler say that? It's because these two men are so justifiably paranoid that someone is always listening in. They've already assumed that De Niro's cover is blown and that he is a known ex-CIA agent. And so they are going to now do a double level of subterfuge, pretending that he is an ex-CIA spook and that this is part of his cover. Like, he will admit that, yes, okay, I was in the CIA. I wasn't supposed to say anything, but okay, yes, I was, but I'm not anymore. I'm just talking to a former employee or former employer. And it works on one level simply for dramatic effect. We're like, okay, yeah, we still believe, okay, because part of who's listening into their conversation is us. And so part of this is for our benefit, but then also they're doing it because they don't know who's listening to this. And I just think it's a great example of the dizzying levels of tradecraft and paranoia that are at play, that they are already assuming that even that their whispers, the stuff they're pretending no one can hear, they're assuming that's being listened to somehow. Someone with a long range mic is listening to them right now, and that they have to pretend that they do. Okay, yeah, we do know each other, but we don't hang out anymore. We don't work together anymore. You've quit, remember? And it's just a moment of exceptional and very complex tradecraft that only pays off once you've seen the film a number of times and you realize the levels of performance that are going on. They are playing characters who are playing characters who are playing characters. And in that sequence, you get maybe the ultimate defining line of this film, if you do buy into my read of it as this hyper anti-capitalist diatribe. What does Vincent tell Sam as they're walking away from that car and they got to figure out what to do. Everyone's your brother until the rent comes due. If that is not a better description of what capitalism is, everyone's your brother until the rent comes due. And of course, that pays off. That line pays off both literally and figuratively. Ooh, listen to me. That pays off literally and figuratively at the end, where Jean Reno's Vincent ends up being the one who pays the bill when it comes due. Because De Niro's hand is so shot up. But yeah, I love that sequence. I love it because it just shows how complicated this situation is for these characters. And I think it is the movie in microcosm, because it is showing the layers of lies that these people are operating beneath to just simply speak to each other on the street. They're having to do two different levels of lies to get to a level of truth. And that's such pure Frankenheimer espionage Manchurian Candidate shit, and I love it. I love it. I love it. I absolutely love it. And another thing I love, as you said, we get the kind of the ultimate reveal that Gregor is an absolute psychopath. Absolute psychopath. Because what kind of grown ass normal man would use that gun?
Yes.
That Nintendo gun.
It's not
that
only
is that, insane. It is not, insane. It is only, so goofy.
It's goofy, but it's not only is it goofy, it's like it's crazy that he does it. And then he's like, to just show how crazy he is, there's a park with parents surrounding it.
Yeah.
He's there like pointing it at children, and it's a goofy gun.
But well, in all due respect, again, Frankenheimer is a filmmaker of such rigor. That is a real gun. That's the crazy thing. That's an actual real ass gun. What does De Niro say at the beginning when Sean Bean's like, "What kind of weapon do you want to use?" He says, "You know, it's a tool. You put it in the toolbox. Whatever you know, whatever the job calls for." Again, capitalist shit left and right. Whatever the job calls for, it's the tool that I use. It doesn't matter. You know what's great about Gregor is he's not operating from a place of ego. He's operating from a place of pragmatism. He's a pragmatic capitalist. Everything he's doing, all of these betrayals are in pursuit of one thing, a suitcase of money so that he no longer has to work. He is as driven to chase money as every other character in this film, besides, as we will discover, Sam, who's only chasing Seamus. Seamus was chasing money. But I just want to say that he is a psychopath, but he's a psychopath for one thing. It's not for satisfying his ego, for proving that, you know, he's not the typical Bond villain or Mission Impossible villain. And I think this film has a lot of ties to that first De Palma Mission Impossible. He's not a Mission Impossible villain where it's taking over the world or showing his intellectual prowess and proving to everyone that he's, you know, the baddest boy on the block. He just wants fucking money. Just wants money. And he will kill a little girl at a playground with a fucking Nintendo Duck Hunt pistol to prove it. Real quick, just so everybody knows, that is a real gun. That is a Glock 17L, and the 17L has a longer barrel than the regular Glock 17, so that you can add little attachments, which he did. That is a hollow sight 400. That's a real sight that you can add. Puts a little laser dot on things, and he's got that little suppressor on it and an extra magazine.
Yeah.
Now what is that? That is the gun that is used by someone who does not care if they look cool. He's not a cowboy. He's not a Wangro. He is not a cowboy looking.
He's not Vincent Hanna with a pearl handled gun. Nope.
He's actually following De Niro's ethos, Sam's ethos at the beginning. It's a tool. Put the tool in the toolbox that you need. Doesn't matter how stupid it looks. if you want a Glock 17L with an extended barrel, an extra magazine, a hollow sight 400, and a suppressor, which, by the way, that suppressor doesn't work because there's a muzzle flash, which you wouldn't get if there was a suppressor on a gun. That goofy ass gun, which always took me out of the scene for a long time when I would watch this movie, because I'd be like, wait a minute, movie, you had me. And now what, like, I'm not going to sing the Duck Hunt theme. I don't want Blake to get sued by Nintendo, but I was like, come on. But it's one of those moments of action as character and production design and production as character, just as much as their sallow, unmade up faces are part of the production design to argue a point and to give window into these characters. Even this guy's goofy fucking gun is an aspect of his character. He is a guy who will use the latest tech, to accomplish his goal in the most ruthless, efficient, capitalist way possible. Yeah. This, you know, it's the gun that Elon Musk would use. and think that he's a real badass because of it.
No, and it's, I just too want to say, it's too small and functional. That's much more garish than that. He's a flamethrower.
As we all know, Musk is a man whose gun is not functional. But moving on. That's what I hear. Just what I hear. But moving on.
Just what I hear. From where?
What I hear. You know,
he went up to a guy with the New York Times in a car park.
People talk, but certain things don't work for the man. You know, what are you going to do? So I love this sequence. I love how every time it cuts to the little girl, the movie abruptly shifts to slow motion, which is actually something that Frankenheimer doesn't like to use in his action sequences. Mm-hmm. He likes them to be short, staccato, and brutal. But I love these moments where it will cut from real time to slow motion every time we focus on the girl. That is just pure Frankenheimer auteurism and his style of filmmaking, the meshing of the artful and the lovely with the abrupt and the brutal and the violent. And I think that he really was a true auteur in so many ways, up to and including lacing and layering this film with his own personal idiosyncrasies. He was a man who loved ice skating, which is why we have the ice skating sequence written into the film. He's a man that loved to make little models. That is why we have a character who makes little models, and that's why they use those models to explain the title of the film, which is about a bunch of unemployed samurai. And in one, you know, final little bit, I love that the man, the dapper man, as I believe he's credited, the go-between between Gregor and the Russian mafia, he's sipping his little dainty cunty little cup of espresso before they meet. And if you look at that actor, he's all made up. He's all handsomed up. He's all made up, as is Mickey, the head of the Russian mafia. And I think it's interesting and telling, to go back to what I was saying, how management is very bourgeoisie in this film. They're very handsome. They're very tanned. They're very well-groomed, well-manicured. They've got money. Even when they're complaining that they don't have enough money, they've got money. They have got bougie tastes. They do bougie things. They're dating ice skaters, and they're hanging out at massive ice skating events. They're sitting at these expensive little cafes with their little cups of espresso and their little three-piece suits with their regular guns that don't look like they've been kitbashed from Legos. And it's just another bit of business in this film, in Glengarry Glen Ronan, that I just don't think you get in other films of this sort, of this type. I think everything in this film is designed and built to coalesce into a single argument, which is, geez, working sucks.
That concludes episode 7 of Row Min, our series on John Frankenheimer's Ronin from 1998. If you want to find out what else is going on at One Heat Minute Productions, you just need to go to oneheatminute.com or check us out on the socials at OHMPods or myself at @OneBlakeMinute. If you enjoy everything we do, there's so much bonus content over at our Patreon, which is patreon.com/OneHeatMinute, including our rear view look back series, The Decade Project, and our upcoming film club called The Juice. So get over there to support us for as little as $1 a month. I want to say a huge thank you to my amazing collaborator on Increment Vice and special guest on this show, Travis Woods. There is nobody who does it like Travis. But once we triangulate where Gregor is, we will arrive at scene number 8, 1 hour, 1 minute, and 22 seconds, up to 1 hour and 14 minutes, 48 seconds. We're going to Arles. Enter the Colosseum.
Well, I'll be. A hitchhiker in an Easter Bunny costume. Hop in. Where are you headed?
BJ's Wholesale Club to do my Easter shopping. I have so many baskets to fill.
That costume is so lifelike. There's not even a zipper.
Oh, there's BJ's. I can hop out here.
Look at him go.
Get a $15 digital coupon when you spend $150 on practically anything in one transaction through April 20th. Coupon will appear in your digital gallery on April 24th. Terms apply. Go to BJ's.com/Easter coupon for details. BJ's. Absurdly simple savings.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.